My notes show that Wayland Academy students are here. If they are, would they please stand? Goodness. Well, thank you all for coming. Here I gave the graduation speech at Wayland Academy, and I was delighted to be there. Please be seated. The students are here with a program sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. The program is called Court with Class. Students are invited to come, listen to an oral argument. If they accept the invitation, they are given some materials about this case that they are to hear, and they can engage, if they wish, in various activities relating to the case. They then come to court and will meet with a justice assigned that day to discuss the procedures of the court with the students, not the substantive issues of the case, and everyone is invited to attend that discussion, including counsel. And let me introduce the court to all of you. On my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Robinsack. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Brooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and to her right, Justice David Prosser, and on the far right, Justice Annette Ziegler. As you know, this was theoretically scheduled to begin at 10:45, and we ran over. And for that, we apologize to the students and to counsel. What we're going to do is hear this entire case and not break for lunch until it is completed. So my estimate is if we stay timely that this case will conclude at about 20 to 1. And then if the students are still available, there'll be a discussion with Justice Gableman. So we will proceed on that basis. I hope that that does not interfere with any lunch plans that council has. Okay with you if I proceed? Okay. All right. With that understanding, we are going to hear our second case today, 07AP2767CR, State versus John A. Wood. And we have this lineup. Kristen, is it Lecker? For 13 minutes representing Mr. Wood. James Groskel of Skadden Arps representing the Disability Rights of Wisconsin, National Disability Rights Network. And the Judge David Bazelon, Center for Mental Health Law, for 12 minutes. And then Mr. Harlow, Dwayne Harlow, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin for 30. And Ms. Lecker, you will do the rebuttal, according to my notes. You've ceded your 12 minutes to the amicus. And we will need a pro hoc vici for Mr. Grossgall, and that will be done, my notes show, by Wisconsin Attorney Christian Kirschensteiner, right? Okay. You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, I'm Kristen Laker, here from Wessel Laker in Kumel, on behalf of the defendant appellant John Wood. Mr. Wood suffers from paranoid schizophrenia.
Sorry, but you'll have to get closer to the microphone and maybe reposition it.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Wood suffers from paranoid schizophrenia. He resides at Mendota Mental Health Facility as an NGI acquittee and is subject to an order for the forced administration of psychotropic drugs. We're here today asking the court to vacate that order. There's no dispute that everyone, including John Wood, has a significant liberty interest in bodily integrity. and deciding for themselves what they ingest and what they refuse. And this liberty interest is only heightened when the substance proposed to be ingested, forcibly injected, psychotropic drugs, carries the risks that are widely acknowledged here: lifelong debilitating side effects, possibly death. Forcible injection of psychotropic drugs is considered a substantial interference with liberty. And thus, the state's interest in forcibly injecting Mr. Wood must be, the court has put it in various ways, essential according to Sell versus the United States, compelling concerns according to Riggins versus Nevada. The Court of Appeals, in its certification opinion in this case, said that there must be a compelling state interest. A central issue here, then, is what is the state's interest that justifies such a significant intrusion into Mr. Wood's liberty? As the U.S. Supreme Court put it in the Sell case, has the government, in light of the efficacy, the side effects, the possible alternatives, and the medical appropriateness of a particular course of antipsychotic drug treatment, shown a need for that treatment sufficiently important to overcome the individual's protected interest in refusing it?
Counselor, you know, I was interested when I read Sell and also Riggs in that they brought in Sixth Amendment concerns, because what they were bothered with was whether he had a full and fair trial given the administration of psychotropic drugs. Here, we're not involved with the trial. Does that matter, or should it matter, to our analysis of the issue you bring to us?
I think it matters only insofar as there have only been found two compelling justifications for this significant intrusion. One is the one you talked about, the trial concerns, the state's interest in making sure justice is served by bringing someone to trial, and then preventing the harm from someone who's dangerous. Other than that, I don't think those concerns are relevant to this analysis.
Counsel, can you clarify for me, are you making an as-applied challenge, a facial challenge, both kinds of challenges, or doesn't it matter?
I'm making both, Your Honor.
Okay, can you distinguish for me exactly what it is that you're doing to make each challenge?
Okay, in the cases it was applied to Mr. Wood, there are constitutional flaws really throughout the process as we see it. There is no requirement of dangerousness in the statute, and the court made no finding that Mr. Wood is dangerous. There is the administrative directive that the state introduced at one point, which contains its own constitutional flaws as it's written and as it's applied to Mr. Wood. And then on the facial, as it's written challenge, really the same issues. The constitutional flaws that are in the statute, that are in the administrative directive, and that exist because it's an administrative directive.
Okay, so you're asking us to toss the statute out, saying it's unconstitutional, but you're also asking us to make a finding that as applied to your client, it's unconstitutional.
Yes, I am, Your Honor.
How does this work with Chapter 51? When you do, I'm thinking of findings I made at the trial court level, and when someone's involuntarily medicated in a Chapter 51, in the language of that statute, you determine whether they are competent to basically decide if they can make good choices about medication, right? There isn't necessarily that and dangerousness component. The dangerousness component in 51 comes in, for example, in the initial finding of commitment. Help me out with that. Are those unconstitutional as well, or that's likely the next challenge? Help me out with that.
I think that the dangerousness requirement must be present under any circumstances.
For the initial commitment.
And for the next step of the forced administration of psychotropic drugs.
Do you believe that occurs in a Chapter 51 right now?
I'm sorry?
Do you believe that occurs in a Chapter 51 right now? With respect to the medication issue, do you believe courts are making a finding of dangerousness when determining involuntary medication in the 51?
I believe they are, Your Honor, but I can't speak to that absolutely. I'm not certain.
Take a look at the statute if you might. When, I don't want to take your time up now, but you come back up later.
Also, maybe you can help me out with something. The administrative directive is part of the record here. How do you see that fitting into your challenges, both the as-applied challenge and the facial challenge. In other words, when we look at the facial challenge, can we look at it in the light of the administrative directive?
I don't think we can, Your Honor. I guess two answers to that. One is the administrative directive does not have any force of law. It's an internal statement of policy, and I don't believe there's dispute about that. It was not enacted as a rule pursuant to the Administrative Procedures Act. So it's an inadequate mechanism for safeguarding these rights. It should have been enacted as a rule, but even if we assume that it applies and is in effect, it still has constitutional deficiencies. It makes some progress toward correcting the flaws. It requires consideration of less intrusive alternatives, which is essential in the analysis. It requires administrative review after the initial 6 months, but it contains a definition of dangerousness that is so broad and vague as to be practically no discernible standard at all.
Was it followed in regard to your client?
We do not dispute that it was followed. Yes. But the standard contained includes such things as may suffer significant anxiety, a risk of physical harm considering the history of violence with no requirement of immediacy, which really is exemplified in this case. And the incidents occurred in 78 and 98, and those pretty much form the basis of the state's contention that Mr. Wood presents a current danger. And the state, in its supplemental brief, says that the subheadings contained in the administrative directive are not the only circumstances for a finding of dangerousness. They're just areas that the institution may assess, so it's very vague. It also provides insufficient procedural protections. The independence of the decision maker has been considered crucial, really throughout this jurisprudence in Ennis and Harper. And after the initial court order here, there's no provision for independent review unless it's initiated by the patient himself. Harper strongly supports the need for an independent decision maker. It also provides for one review after 6 months and then annual review. Again, insufficient procedural protection for this kind of an intrusion, for drugs that can have a changing impact on a person, for a person whose competence and dangerousness is certainly not static, but changes over time. The state really has offered no compelling interests under these circumstances that warrant this intrusion. It describes interests that might overcome Mr. Wood's right as relevant and legitimate, but nothing that's compelling. Much of the dispute here centers on the issue of dangerousness. Courts have found, and Mr. Wood concedes, that if compelled medication is essential for the safety of himself or others, then the government's interest is sufficiently overriding or compelling to warrant the intrusion. But in this case, dangerousness is not required under the statute, and it was not established regarding Mr. Wood.
How do you line that proposition up with Sell? I didn't read the Supreme Court as requiring dangerousness in Sell.
Well, Sell, I think, first of all, didn't consider this exact case. Dangerousness in that case, Sell said dangerousness is not the only acceptable justification, but the only other one put forward in Sell was making a pretrial detainee able to stand trial. So two justifications that courts have found over the years, and it's our position that that limited list should not be expanded. Ennis is the case from the Western District that obviously is only persuasive authority here, but presents a very helpful roadmap to the constitutional flaws. And one of its main concerns is that there is no requirement of dangerousness. As the Ennis court said, only present dangerousness and present need for medication justify the significant intrusion represented by the forced administration of psychotropic drugs. So without dangerousness and without the interest in being brought to trial, there's no state interest that justifies this intrusion. And I think it's important to keep in mind that the intrusion is enormous, that forced mental health services are often described as a massive curtailment of liberty. That's from Vitek versus Jones. The administration of the drugs is of questionable, inconsistent efficacy, has devastating devastating side effects, affects personality, demeanor, behavior. Really, apart from involuntary commitment itself, it's difficult to imagine a more intrusive infringement upon a person's basic liberty.
So you don't think that the government interest in helping the defendant in his condition, in improving his medical condition, is enough of an interest to administer these drugs?
I do not, Your Honor.
So that you think that if the person is languishing in a mental institution or penal institution, here it's a mental institution, and you can't get him to consent, can you, because he's incompetent, right? So the state wants to administer these drugs. The state has to ultimately go to court to do it? Question mark?
Yes.
And so the state shows that it's in his best medical interests. And then there's a wonderful drug. It has its side effects, but it's a wonderful drug. And then he can be rendered competent, can be rendered able to have a quality of life in the institution, which he doesn't now. That's not good enough.
I don't believe it is, Your Honor. A couple of points on that. One is that the scope of the right should not change based upon whether the person is competent. Now, we don't dispute that there comes a point where the person's illness, including likely John Wood's illness, is so acute that he will present a genuine danger to himself, where he stops eating, he physically injures himself, he makes threats to other people. But in this case, we're not at that point, and the state's allegations showing that John Wood presents a danger are so weak that they really constitute a pretext, so weak that they likely would apply to many persons residing at Mendota. I see that my time has expired. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. You'll have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Attorney Olsensteiner.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm an attorney with Disability Rights Wisconsin, the Protection and Advocacy System for the State of Wisconsin, and one of the amici in this case. I would like to introduce the attorney James Grosko, who will make the arguments on behalf of the amici.
Mr. Grosko is a lawyer in good standing in New York.
Yes, he is, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel. He will be admitted to argue this case at that point of the end of the argument. He's no longer admitted. We're delighted to welcome you from New York City. You may take the podium.
Thank you, Ms. Christian Center. Thank you, Your Honors. To please the Court, my name is James Grosko. My colleague Michael Balch and I are attorneys in good standing in New York, and we are pro bono counsel to organizations National Disability Rights Network, Disability Rights Wisconsin, and the Judge David L. Bazelon Center for Mental Health Law. These organizations have a common mission to ensure that persons with disabilities do not lose their liberty simply because they have disabilities. In this case, we ask the Court to ensure that the right to remain disabled is not abrogated absent clear and convincing evidence that a person is actually dangerous, and absent clear and convincing evidence that the drugs in question are medically appropriate. This case is not about the menace posed by Mr. Wood. Mr. Wood will not be released from Mendota until he is prepared for reintegration into society. If he poses an imminent risk of physical harm to himself or others within the facility, then Mendota already possesses an emergency medication power under Chapter 51. Rather, this case is about the right of nonviolent persons to refuse psychoactive drugs. Over the last two generations, this Court and others have tried to balance the constitutional rights of persons with the state's paternal interest in helping those who are unable to care for their basic needs. When there is no finding of imminent dangerousness, and when there is no finding that a person is unable to care for his basic needs, these cases become line-drawing exercises. At what point does the state's parens patriae interest in treatment outweigh the individual's right to be left alone? This Court recognized in In re L.W. that incapacity to refuse treatment does not extinguish the constitutional right to refuse it. The focus of today's analysis, therefore, should not be whether a person is incompetent to, who is incompetent to refuse medication retains a constitutional right to refuse treatment, but what standards and procedures must be in place to ensure that this constitutional right is protected. In particular, this court must decide whether the psychiatric facility treating Mr. Wood should be permitted to exercise or abrogate its own patient's constitutional rights.
But we don't know whether he's denied treatment or he isn't. We just don't know because he's incompetent, right?
I believe that the record indicates that he has refused the treatment and...
I know, but we can't. Can we give effect to his refusal when he's incompetent?
There are means of affecting a competent refusal to take medication. And in this case, Mr. Wood was competent at the moment that he discontinued the drugs. Unfortunately, under the administrative directive, a person who is competent to refuse medication can nevertheless be forcibly medicated. Ultraviolence of the statute, if his psychiatric facility team believes that he would no longer be competent to refuse the drugs in the event of discontinuation of the drugs.
A person has moments of competency, and moments of incompetency.
And amici argue, and there's ample psychiatric and legal support for the proposition, that incompetence is not a permanent condition. It may exist only briefly, for instance, during psychotic breaks. And in those circumstances, if a person does present an imminent danger to himself or others, forcible medication is already permitted under Chapter 51.
So your position is that he has refused treatment?
It's clear in the record that he has refused treatment. Now he has consented to the drugs, but does not believe that he should be under a forcible medication order to take them, is my understanding from the record.
Okay.
Counsel, does your position in regard to dangerousness run contrary to the Sell decision by the United States Supreme Court?
I believe that the position of the amicus organizations is consistent with Sell. Sell required that the state demonstrate a substantial interest in overriding the individual's right to refuse medication. In the case of Sell, there was a compelling state interest in forcibly medicating Dr. Sell, who was a pretrial detainee, for the interests of the justice that would be served to society by medicating him and making him competent to stand trial. However, the Supreme Court in Sell also said that the condition of his continuing confinement would reduce the substantiality of the state's interest in forcibly medicating him to make him stand trial, since he was being deprived of his liberty by remaining in a psychiatric treatment facility. So Sell is apposite, and Sell places a high standard of review when it comes to the constitutional rights of a person in a position like Mr. Woods.
These are not fundamental rights, though, correct?
It is a fundamental right to refuse medication.
I don't think Sell said it was a fundamental liberty interest. I think they said it was a substantial liberty interest, and they didn't apply strict scrutiny as they would have were it a fundamental right, correct?
They also did not apply the rational basis test in Harper, which is the state's position that this court should apply.
Mm-hmm. So, about the intermediate test, do you think that's what they applied here?
I believe in this case a fundamental liberty interest is retained by Mr. Wood. But if you choose to apply Sell to the extent of the intermediate test, that would certainly be better than the position taken by the state.
I think even the Western District of Wisconsin, on which your co-counsel relies, said it was a substantial liberty interest, but not a fundamental one.
Even if it were a substantial interest, Your Honor, the state still has not established that they have met it.
Thank you.
How is the situation different when you've got a finding, as you have here, of not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect? Does that seem to be somewhat contrary to the position that you're taking? You've already got that determination made.
The finding of not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect neither extinguishes the right to refuse medication nor creates a presumption that the person is dangerous. The state has no punitive interest in giving Mr. Wood these drugs.
Can you look at the elements of the crime with which the defendant was charged here in determining dangerousness?
You've
got a finding of not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect.
The statute permits an inference to be made from a finding of not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect at the time that a person is committed to a psychiatric facility pursuant to Chapter 971. But the farther away we get from the offense that brought a person into involuntary criminal commitment, the less weight courts and other decision makers should give in making a determination of dangerousness on those grounds. If it was an offense 10 years ago, that tells you very little about the prospects for imminent dangerousness. And I do see my time is up. Thank you. Unless Your Honor has
I do have a question. What about the procedural issue that in the statute itself, there isn't a provision for a review every X number of months or years? There is, of course, the right of the person to seek release.
Your Honor is absolutely correct. In Anthony D.B., a case involving a person subject to a medication or potentially subject to a medication under order under Chapter 980, this court held that mandatory periodic independent review was a constitutional sine qua non for any forcible medication order. And in that case, the court incorporated Chapter 51, which requires mandatory independent review by a court. In this case, there are none of the hallmarks of procedural due process for subsequent renewals of the medication order. Instead, an internal psychiatric panel composed of treatment staff and on appeal the members of the psychiatric facility make determinations about the person's dangerousness, about his competence, which the statute makes clear is a judicial determination. The person has no right to counsel, and the person does not have any access to an independent decision-making body.
About the fact that this particular person, Mr. Wood, has petitioned for conditional release, I understand, 7 times. Doesn't that provide some periodic review?
It does not provide periodic review, Your Honor, of the forcible medication order. Mr. Wood is a person who does have much more intellectual capacity and cognitive capacity than other people who are in commitment subject to Section 17. He has been very diligent in trying to pursue his rights. Unfortunately, other people who live with mental disabilities, other people who are subject to forcible medication that impairs their cognitive capacity, might not be in a position to take so aggressive an approach in exercising their right to refuse treatment.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
We're very pleased to have you for about 15 minutes. Dwayne Harlow, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin.
Thank you, Chief Justice Abrahamson. May it please the court, my name is R. Dwayne Harlow, and I am an Assistant Attorney General practicing with the Wisconsin Department of Justice, and I do represent the plaintiff respondent, State of Wisconsin, in this matter. We've heard of what they think that this case is about, but I submit to this court that what this case is truly about is about the state's ability to provide John Wood with the help that he needs. This case is about the ability of the state to help John Wood obtain treatment that is necessary for his mental illness, and it's about the state's ability to help John Wood with help to promote his own interests and medical best interests. When Wood, in the underlying case in this matter, established the affirmative defense of not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect, he established 2 things. He established that he acted in a criminal way, or at least acted in a manner that constituted a criminal act, and he also established that he committed this act because of his extreme mental illness. There can be no dispute that those are 2 findings that have been had by a judicial proceeding. Dr. Smith testified that Wood carries a diagnosis of schizophrenia, and that diagnosis has been consistent during the period of both of Mr. Wood's commitments and remains to be his current diagnosis at this time. Thus, it is well established that John Wood suffers from a very serious mental illness, and that this mental illness is the root cause of criminal acts on his part. Moreover, following a verdict of not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect, Wood's commitment to institutional care establishes his dangerousness. We've heard counsel allege and assert that the fact that he was found not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect does not establish his dangerousness. I would submit that, in fact, it does, to a degree, establish his...
Does it establish that he has a mental illness?
It establishes that he has a mental illness, Chief Justice Abrahamson, and it also establishes that that mental illness has caused him to act in a criminal manner. And the Supreme Court has indicated that criminal acts are concrete evidence of an individual's dangerousness.
Suppose it was 20 years old, and he's been there for 20 years.
Yes.
Does that fact that what he did 20 years deal with his dangerousness now? Or is this one factor to be considered?
I think that it would be one factor to be considered. I don't think that it is ipso facto a danger on the part of Mr. Wood. But I would assert this, Chief Justice.
So we don't have a finding of dangerousness.
Excuse me?
We don't have a finding of dangerousness.
I submit that there is a finding of dangerousness by the fact that Mr. Wood is confined to institutional care. Under the holdings of the United States Supreme Court in Jones, an individual may not be confined when that individual no longer poses a danger. Moreover, under the statutory scheme set up by the state of Wisconsin, an individual is entitled to his conditional release unless the clear and convincing evidence establishes that his release would pose a danger.
So the fact that he's still there per se means he's dangerous?
The fact that he is still there, Your Honor, per se establishes his dangerousness. If Mr. Wood is in fact not dangerous, then we shouldn't be before this court arguing about whether he should be subjected to an involuntary medication order. We should be here arguing about whether or not he should be released to conditional care under 97117 sub 4.
So is it your position that dangerousness is a requirement?
It is not my position that dangerousness is a requirement, Your Honor. What I'm saying is if we look at the facial application, as they've alleged in response to Justice Ziegler's question, regarding a facial challenge as well as a case-specific applied challenge, I'm saying that Mr. Wood is a danger. I'm saying that a danger is not necessarily required. And what I'm also saying is that by the fact that a person is not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect and confined to institutional care, that individual is per se dangerousness. Therefore, any sort of a finding that the court has to make, an additional finding of dangerousness, would be redundant and unnecessary. Mr. Wood has established his dangerousness when he invoked the insanity defense.
I thought you were going to say when he sought release, because had he not sought release for 10 years, would you still say that ipso facto being confined, he's dangerous?
I would submit, Your Honor, the statute doesn't only contemplate an individual being released upon his petition for conditional release, it also provides for the director of the facility to release that individual. So, under the holdings of the United States Supreme Court, I think the fact that the individual is confined to institutional care is evidence of his dangerousness. Absent his dangerousness, his confinement in institutional care is in fact inappropriate and unlawful, I would submit to this court.
So your position is if you're confined in prison, you must have done the act because otherwise you couldn't be confined.
No, Your Honor, that's not my position. That an individual who's confined in prison must have done the act, otherwise he wouldn't be confined. My position is that the evidence has established to a clear and convincing degree Mr. Wood's dangerousness by the fact that he is, in fact, being held in institutional care. And I think that that is something separate and distinct. Because what we are really arguing about here, Chief Justice Abrahamson, is their alleged requirement, Wood's alleged request, that a clear and convincing finding of dangerousness be had before this medication order may be administered. And what I'm submitting to the court is that it has been had, and it can be inferred by his confinement in institutional care.
It gets rid of the dangerousness from your standpoint. What about the procedural issue that he doesn't get periodic reviews automatically?
Your Honor, I think that he does get periodic reviews, number one, under the administrative directive, but I would submit that the periodic review can be had by the treating physicians at the institution. Again, when Mr. Wood is institutionalized, he is placed there not only for the protection of the public, he is also placed there for the purposes of treatment. Again, in Jones versus United States, the Supreme Court indicated that a person's commitment to institutional care for a finding of not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect is there for the purposes of protection of the public and for the commitment and treatment of the criminally committed individual.
Wasn't that the same argument that was advanced years ago with regard to Chapter 55, that there didn't have to be independent reviews, but rather the treating physicians in the institution provided sufficient
review? Are you referring to the Roberta S. case, I believe?
No, I'm not referring to that, but take it away.
Very well, Judge. I think that there are different considerations when we have a not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect consideration here. Because the individual has been, again, established to be meet this dangerousness standard. And again, the Supreme Court has ruled that the interests of the state in providing the treatment are real and significant. I would further submit, Justice Bradley, that to the extent that we are talking about regular review, the court has never held that that has to be a judicial review. In Washington versus Harper, there was no judicial process that provided for judicial review. It was a review that was had within the institution. And I don't see any reason why the medical judgment of the medical professional should not be honored in this regard as well.
Well, did he have the opportunity to bring in his own expert?
He did, Your Honor. Under 971.17.3, Mr. Wood could have brought in an expert for an independent evaluation regarding his competency and presumably also the issue of whether or not the medication was appropriate.
Every time he was examined?
Every time that he was examined by the medical personnel at Mendota, no, that would not be something that would be contemplated in there, Your Honor, that he would be having the opportunity to have his own independent physician available. And I would submit that that is not a very efficient or effective manner of administering a medical treatment to an individual.
How does he get periodic review of these medical analyses without bringing his own petition for a kind of release?
Your Honor, I would submit that to the extent that the court were to determine that administrative review would be something that, or strike that, that review of the medication order would be appropriate outside of the treatment review, I think that the petition for review can be accomplished through the petition for conditional release. But assuming Your Honor's mechanism that he is not going to be brought in on a petition for review, there also is under 51617 a right of an individual to bring an action in court any time that he believes that his patient rights under 5161 have been violated in any way, shape, or form. So I think that that would also provide an effective means of review.
Do you think that if this statute were unconstitutional on its face, that it can be repaired by an administrative procedure?
Your Honor, I think that the administrative directive and the administrative procedure could repair it to the extent that the court felt that Washington versus Harper struck the appropriate balance.
And how would the court do that?
Well, Your Honor, I think that by the fact that the court can create through its opinion what it believes due process requires, I would submit that the administrative directive is not fatal because it is a directive and not an administrative rule. It is not the agency's interpretation of the statute. The agency merely sets forth a procedure by which it attempted to comply with what it believed to be an erroneous decision by the federal district court. This isn't the agency...
That appealed?
It was not appealed, Your Honor. In 1996, I would have been only a year out of law school. It wasn't my decision to do at that time. I can't tell the court why it wasn't...
You're released from liability.
I'm released from liability. Thank you, Chief Justice.
But it doesn't release the Attorney General from the question of appeal.
I'm sure that there's probably a very good reason why it wasn't.
Not going into that, right?
But I do not know why it was not appealed. But I can tell you that I do not believe that the administrative directive constitutes any sort of a concession by the administrative agency that Ennis was in any way correct or that a dangerousness standard should be required. It was only a manner of trying to come up with a procedure so that the administrative agency, the Department of Health Services, did not run afoul of the federal district court.
Counsel, I think it's important, at least for me, to make sure that we aren't mixing apples and oranges. There's the concept of conditional release, and one can petition for conditional release, right?
Correct.
And in order for someone to be held and not conditionally released, they must be determined to be dangerous.
The clear and convincing evidence must establish that.
This is not an appeal of a finding regarding conditional release.
True.
Or denial of that, right?
Correct.
This is an appeal of a separate motion brought by the doctor of the facility saying, I need to be able to have a court order to involuntarily medicate this individual, right?
That is correct.
And so the challenge is being made to 971.17.3, specifically, I think, 3C that discusses that kind of order, not conditional release or denial of conditional release, right?
That's correct.
So when we're talking about the section and the order that are being appealed here, we have to look at what the legislature set forth as the kind of determination that needs to be made if someone is going to be potentially forcibly administered medication, right?
I believe that you have to look at the statutory framework as a whole.
Simply stated, if someone's committed, since the presumption is you're conditionally released unless you're dangerous, and the fact that he's not conditionally released already deals with that under sub 3, right?
Correct.
Okay. But when you go to the next tier of analysis, that is, can someone be forcibly medicated, right?
Yes.
You have to go through and see if the court made the proper findings under sub C, 3C, right?
That's correct.
And 3C doesn't talk about dangerousness, does it?
It does not talk about dangerousness.
It just talks about whether or not someone's competent to refuse medication, much like it does in Chapter 51, right?
It talks about whether someone is not competent to refuse medication, Justice Ziegler, but it also talks about whether or not the individual needs the medication or treatment and is not competent to refuse. So it's not simply a matter of whether or not the individual is not competent to refuse. Right. The other issue is brought before the court.
Point well taken. But also, the idea of writing dangerousness into that provision is something that's somewhat new, right?
Correct.
I'm just trying to make sure that we're not mixing up the idea of conditional release and an order that's not being appealed relating to that with the order that is being appealed, and that is the order relating to involuntary medication.
Yes, Justice Ziegler, and it is the position of the state that there does not need to be read into 971.17.3c requirement of dangerousness. My mere fact that I brought up 971.17.4 was in response to the allegation that there is no dangerousness. This individual doesn't pose a dangerousness or a dangerous standard at all. I don't believe that there's a requirement of dangerousness that is required because the state's interests are so compelling here. Again, what we have is we have an individual who has established that he has a mental illness and that this mental illness causes him to act in manners that do not conform to the criminal code. As a result of that, the state has been charged with the duty and responsibility of treating that individual. The state has a duty and responsibility and interest in protecting the public, and the protection of the public will be had by the treatment of that individual so that he can be safely returned to society, because under 971.17.4, again, he's entitled to conditional release, and ultimately under 971.17.1, he's entitled to his release after two-thirds of what his maximum sentence would have been. So this individual is scheduled to get out. This individual is scheduled to be reintroduced into society, and this individual has, by, again, invoking the insanity defense, attempted to ask for help for his reintroduction into society.
Well, I agree that the state has a duty to give medical treatment to people within its confines. So I think of a person in a mental institution or a prison has appendicitis, the state has an obligation to get them to the hospital. Question is that, is there a duty to treat when it's not life-threatening and when the patient doesn't want it?
Chief Justice Abrahamson, I would assert that Mr. Wood is incapable of expressing whether or not he wants it.
According to the to Mr. Wood's counsel, that when we agree he can be competent sometimes and incompetent others, right?
Your Honor, I believe that with medication, at times he may be competent, correct.
And then he said he didn't want any more medication.
And I'm not aware that the record establishes that. Chief Justice, I've heard the representation of counsel.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But you think the state has a duty to treat even when the person doesn't want to be treated?
I think that the state has a compelling interest in treating the individual even though he or she may not want to be treated, yes.
And what's the compelling interest?
The compelling interest, again, Chief Justice Abrahamson, is in the protection of the public from the future criminal conduct of individuals such as Mr. Wood.
He's not getting out.
Well, he is scheduled to get out, and I don't think that it's a sufficient response merely to say that, well, we'll just simply civilly commit him and the state of Wisconsin will keep him committed for the rest of his life. And that leads to the second point, that the state also has an interest in protecting and promoting the interests of the vulnerable individuals such as Mr. Wood himself. Mr. Wood does not have the mental capacity to exercise a right to refuse treatment. Someone has to act as his surrogate, and I would
say... To me, the state's interest is also to get him out of the institution and reduce expenses.
I think that that's one of the interests that a state always has, Chief Justice Abrahamson, but I would not submit that that is the overriding interest that the state has at stake here. I think that the interest, the overriding and most important legitimate interests, are the interests in protection of the public and also in the interests of protecting, again, the vulnerable members of society such as Mr. Wood. Mr. Wood, since approximately 1978, has spent all but about 7 years committed. So the fact that Mr. Wood is not able to adequately control his treatment doesn't only impact upon society through the murder that he committed in 1978 or the forced sexual assault that he committed in 1998, it also has significant negative consequences to Mr. Wood himself. It results in his continued confinement within the institution and the loss of the most sacred of liberty interests, which would be the freedom of bodily restraint. So
it's like the old joke, I'm from the Internal Revenue Service and I'm here to help you.
Is there a punchline in there? I always thought that the Internal Revenue Service was always there to help me.
Right. Well, that's your argument.
How naive that I am.
There was a hearing earlier this year. Is that right?
Are you talking about the on remand, Justice Prosser?
May 6, 2009.
Yes, yes.
Now, is he taking medication now, voluntarily or involuntarily?
He's taking the medication voluntarily. The testimony of Dr. Smith is that he's taking the medication voluntarily. However, he knows that the involuntary medication order is out there. And what effect the fact that that order was out there had on his decision to voluntarily consume the medications, I do not know.
Is he fighting the medication right now?
My understanding, other than through this proceeding here, there is no ongoing dispute with the treatment providers. But again, Justice Prosser, I'm not aware of that. All that I know is that Mr. Wood is voluntarily consuming the medications that have been prescribed to him. At the time that this action initially arose, it was risperidone. It's now, I think, clozapine.
Think this is moot?
Your Honor, I don't think that it's moot under the court's prior holdings, because I do agree with the Court of Appeals that it probably presents an issue of recurring significance to this court. Again, I think that to the extent that the statute doesn't require dangerousness that is appropriate and complies with due process. And again, I guess in the alternative, to the extent that the court determines that a finding of dangerousness is required or that Washington versus Harper strikes the appropriate balance, I would submit that the administrative directive complies in total with that.
Counsel, I'm concerned of the interplay of it between Chapter 51, where involuntary medication order does not require a finding of dangerousness, and the interplay between this statute, which is after a finding of guilty, right? I mean, you're first found guilty, and then you're found not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect,
correct?
Right? And then the competency proceedings under 971.14, where someone can be involuntarily administered medication. And in fact, part of the court's findings when someone is determined to be incompetent to stand trial is that they're likely to resume the capacity to be competent. Sometimes that means they are involuntarily medicated even before they might be found guilty,
yes,
so that they can stand trial. And there's no finding of dangerousness in that section either. So I'm trying to get your impressions of how there might be interplay between 51, the competency proceeding and the medication requirement that could occur there even before trial when someone has not been found guilty, and after someone has been found guilty and then found not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect under 971-7.
Correct, Justice Eagler, and I agree. I think that they are both in lockstep. There is no requirement of dangerousness that is required in either. And it gets back somewhat, I think, to my prior statement regarding the inference of dangerousness, even to the extent that it was required. There is, in the Chapter 51, reference to recent acts or omissions of danger or violence as far as getting a commitment order, and there is nothing with respect to whether or not someone has to be currently dangerous or currently present a danger within the institutional confines in order to get medicated. And I think that that is something, Justice Ziegler, that is being lost here today, and that is they are not simply saying that the individual has to be established as a danger. What they are saying is that given the institutional safety, given the institutional controls that are at the disposal of the Mendota Mental Health Institution, that an individual has to present a danger within that unique setting. And again, we don't have any summary requirement in 5160 or in Chapter 51.
What about Chapter 55? How does that inform the discussion? Where there's specific procedures, there's specific annual review that's required by and a guardian ad litem is appointed, an independent review is done. The individual continues to meet the standards for Chapter 55, which is protective placements and services, which requires a substantial showing of harm to self or others. That's one of the requirements for placement. And so in Chapter 55, we have this very delineated procedure, in part as a result of case law, that provides for the annual review of the order authorizing involuntary administration of psychotropic medication. And that's 5519. And the procedure set forth is quite elaborate in that it takes about one full page and a half of a large size statute book. And so, in fact, or more, maybe 1 3/4 page of what has to be done when the person in this annual review of order authorizing involuntary administration of psychotropic medication. And I remember when the case came out that was associated with this, there was a bit of a pause because, of course, we haven't been doing reviews in Chapter 55. And then the case said we had to, and now the statute says we have to. So if 51 informs it, how does 55 inform your analysis?
Well, Your Honor, I will confess that I have not looked at 55 as exhaustively, obviously, as you have, but my understanding is that is the protective placement statute and that the state has an entirely different set of interests there that are only devoted to the interests of the individual in protecting him or her from him or herself.
Not totally. Part of the requirement, the individual continues to meet the standards for protective placement. And I think the standards for protective placement are maybe in 55, I don't know, 08, and someplace in there it would say that he harmed to himself or herself or others. So it isn't just the individual.
Again, Your Honor, I guess that I would have to defer. I haven't referred to that or examined that as exhaustively, perhaps as I should.
Here, let me repeat. Let me 5508 indicates, with regard to the language that I read 5508C, as a result of developmental disability, degenerative brain disorder, serious persistent mental illness, or other like incapacities, the individual is so totally incapable of providing for his own care or custody as to create a substantial risk of serious harm to himself, herself, or others. Serious harm may be evidenced by overt acts or acts of omission.
And I would submit that the consistency between that and 51 and 971 is that the recent acts or omissions is not necessary because in 971 the individual has been already adjudicated to have committed a criminal act and not guilty by reason of his mental disease or defect. And in Chapter 51, the very commitment itself centers around whether or not that individual presents a danger. So to the extent that we don't have the exhaustive procedure outlined in 971 or 51 that we do in 55, it could be perhaps because the dangerousness, again, is inferred by the fact that the individual is committed to institutional care under 971 and that the individual is instituted, or strike that, committed to institutional care under Chapter 51, again, due to the dangerousness that he or she may present. But again, I think that it is very important that what we are dealing with here, again, is not just a requirement of dangerousness. At least that's not the scheme that is being advanced by Wood, and that's not the scheme that was being advanced by Ennis. We are dealing with a situation where what the Ennis court determined was is that the individual had to be a special danger within the institution, such that we should be confining these individuals with restraints, such that we should be isolating and so forth. Chapter 5161 under the patient's rights provides very limited ability of the state in a commitment proceeding to isolate an individual, to restrain an individual. Dr. Smith testified that the restraint of an individual and isolation of an individual is not in the best interest of that individual's treatment. In fact, it can have negative consequences, nor should we have to sit by. And I think that this is very important. Why should we be able to treat an individual simply because he is a danger, give that individual the help that he needs to earn the keys to his release from the mental commitment, whereas another individual, as Chief Justice Abrahamson put it, is languishing here but is not yet quite ripened into a danger, they don't get the same opportunity for the treatment. That is troubling indeed. And I would submit to the court that it is an arbitrary line to be drawn here. The state's interests aren't just in maintaining institutional safety, security, and order as it was in Washington versus Harper, or as the only interest that the court considered in Ennis. The state's interests go beyond that, again, to the protection of the public from future criminal conduct, but also to the extent of treating individuals and protecting the vulnerable members of its society.
What does the state want the court to do? The state didn't appeal Ennis, but doesn't concede Ennis is correct. So what does the state want? Does the state say statute as written is perfectly fine? No right to review periodically the condition of treatment. Just a right if the petitioner seeks release that it could be reviewed then. No need to show dangerousness, right?
Yes,
what else does the state want us to say is not needed here and that the statute's just great?
I think that what the state is asking for the court to do, Your Honor, is to provide and to find that an individual who is criminally committed under 971.17 may be administered medications where the medication is in the interests of the individual, where the individual needs that treatment as provided in 971.17.3c, and where the individual is not competent to refuse those medications or treatment. And I see that the red light has come on.
And how do we review that it's in the interest and that he's not competent? Only on motion of the person objecting to the treatment?
I think that initially, Your Honor, I think that the review can be had just as it is here.
Well, that's a motion, isn't it?
Correct. The department sought the motion to treat. A hearing was held. Mr. Wood was provided the right to counsel. Mr. Wood was provided the right to present evidence. Mr. Wood was provided with a right to cross-examine witnesses. And he was presented with a right to present his own expert opinion if that's what he chose to do. And I think that to the extent that he believes that that finding was erroneous, there's review obviously through the appellate courts. Now, to the extent that the order is not regularly reviewed thereafter, I think that there is nothing wrong nor nothing that violates a due process clause to provide that the medical experts who are best equipped, trained, and educated and have experience with these medications are in the best position to do that. And there's a line of cases going back to Youngberg versus Romeo and so forth that indicate that these decisions at times are best left to the medical experts.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Thank you.
Ms. Lecker.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, Justice Ziegler, to respond to your question, as you pointed out, the state need not establish dangerousness under that statute. But the state talks a great deal about the standard required and comes back repeatedly, I think, to
its contention that Mr. Wood is per se dangerous because he's committed. But what we have to keep in mind, I think, is crucial here, is that the fact that he's dangerous on the street is not the same thing as saying he's dangerous in the context of the institution. There's no case law that I'm aware of holding that the fact that he's dangerous and therefore committed is the same as saying he's dangerous in the context of the institution and requires forced medication.
Counselor, I'm sure you probably do realize, but you know, Mr. Wood, if he's not treated, could spend the rest of his life in prison where he wouldn't have been confined for the rest of his life if he didn't raise an NGI defense. Is that really where you want to go with this?
Yeah, I do realize that, and I certainly agree with you that that is a troubling issue. I think that ultimately, for at least most people in this situation, sooner or later there's going to come a point where they are dangerous under whatever standard we're using, that they are unable to, they won't take food, they won't take water. So at some point, I think it's likely that that finding can be made. We just are not anywhere near that point now, and we don't have the standards that we need to require the state to get to that point.
Counselor, but you know, when I first started practice, I took hearings out at Mendota. You do them in the locked ward out there, okay? And if you give some folks medication and they're at their hearing, they're perfectly competent. But if they are off their medication for a month, then they're not competent. So because these medications often don't make people feel really well, you can understand why they would not want to take something which, if they took it for a significant period of time, could turn themselves around enough that they'd have the opportunity not to be restrained anymore. And I think what you're asking us to say is you have to show he's dangerous out there. Well, when he gets to be dangerous out there, they're either going to lock him up, I mean totally lock him up with the straitjacket and the whole thing, and administer meds. But, you know, once they get him on medications again, he may be lucid and may be able to say, hey, I don't want to take these anymore. So it seems to me what you're arguing is going to create a situation where he's just going to be back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, still within the institution, because, you know, if they've got him medicated, he's not going to be dangerous to them at that moment. But if the drugs don't make him feel good, then he's going to say, I don't want to take them anymore. Well, then you've got to have another hearing. Is he presently dangerous? Well, not when he's on his meds. But I don't know. I find it a troubling scenario because it seems like a lot of these folks are just destined to spend the rest of their lives confined.
It is a troubling story. I don't think there are any happy outcomes in some of these cases. But what we have to do is make sure that we're protecting what are fundamental or at least very important rights, constitutional rights, and make sure the standards are in place that are workable. For example, in this case, the evidence, the record shows that the evidence presented on his incompetence to refuse medication was that he rejected medication despite the recommendations of two psychiatrists. Very low standard. And really, then, I think it's up to the state and up to the psychiatrists at the institution to make the decisions in his best interest. And that is not a standard that I think is acceptable.
Counsel, is there not some logic in the legislature making a determination that, as Mr. Wood did, once you kill somebody and then you say, I did it because I was suffering from a mental illness, you're dangerous until you're ready for conditional release. There's no logic there?
I don't think there is logic there, Your Honor. We've taken away his liberty by putting him in the institution. That's a big step.
And this institution, though, is a mental health facility. It is not a penal institution.
That's correct. But to take then the next step of forcibly medicating him with dangerous drugs requires yet another analysis of his danger. And I think the record shows that the state acknowledges that he's not dangerous in the context of the institution. They say that they can deal with his danger in other ways.
How often does the determination of dangerousness need to be made in your estimation?
I think it needs to be made every time the state wants to take a step such as this one, and then very minimally every 6 months.
But yet he can petition for conditional release every 6 months.
Yes, he can.
And as part of that, the case law says that the court can review at the same time whether the involuntary administration of medication should continue.
It does say that, but it also requires an affirmative step on his part, which is a lot to ask of someone who's mentally ill, institutionalized, drugged.
And yet if you take away the psychotropic medications, what do you suppose that'll do to the likelihood of him regaining his ability to do that?
To take the step of asking for release?
Yes.
I think it probably harms it in most cases. I see that my time has expired. Thank you so much.
Thank you, counsel. On behalf of the court, I want to thank Ms. Licker, Mr. Rosegill, and Mr. Harlow for their arguments today on a very difficult subject administering drugs to an institutionalized person who's incompetent, contrary to his requests. That ends our hearing in 07AP2767-CR, State versus Wood. Court is in recess till 1:30. We'll return to hear the third case. The student should wait if they can, and Justice Gableman will be out shortly. We are in recess.